Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Planet Earth has faced 5 mass extinctions in its lifetime. Now we may be facing the 6th. What have we learned from the previous mass extinctions that can help us avoid a total collapse? With us is Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, and her latest, The 6th Extinction, An Unnatural History. Also with us is Annalee Newitz. She is the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Annalee Newitz is the founding editor of the science website io9.com and a longtime science journalist. I thought we should start with the brief history that you both give us of the planet Earth, the 5 extinctions that precede the one that we were facing now, the 6th extinction. Elizabeth Colbert, let's start with you. You trace this history kind of through the eyes of scientists and how they're figuring out what's happening in each case. What do we know about the causes and consequences of the preceding mass extinctions?
In each case, you're trying to solve a mystery that goes back many millions of years, so there's sort of cold case going back a long, long time. But the very first one of these 5, what are known as the Big 5 mass extinctions, is about 140 million years ago, and that was a time when life was still largely confined to the water, so it was very devastating for aquatic species, but not for land species, because there were no land species, and it seems that that was caused by a cold snap, actually, the causes of which no one knows exactly, but there was a very sudden glaciation of a lot of the planet. And then the very most devastating of all these extinctions was the 3rd, about 250 million years ago, and that came perilously close to wiping out multicellular life altogether. And that, it seems, was caused by, and there are some very unfortunate parallels to what's going on today, by a very, very massive outflux of carbon dioxide, a very massive bout of global warming, ocean acidification. And the very last one, the most recent, about 66 million years ago, the most famous, most popular, as you will, did in the dinosaurs and a lot of other familiar groups, the pterosaurs, for example. And it seems pretty clear that that was caused by an asteroid impact.
Annalee Newitz, you've also explored these. What would you add?
Elizabeth is right on the money in emphasizing the way that these have all been, you know, precipitated by different events, but the result is that all 5 of the mass extinctions kind of come down to habitat change and climate change. And each of them has different features. One was an ice age, one was caused by mega volcanoes, but in the end, the reason why we see so much death is because over a period of hundreds of thousands of years, the climate changes. And of course, when we talk about climate change in the context of mass extinction, you have to consider the definition of mass extinction, which is a period of about 1 million or 2 million years during which over 75% of all species on the planet go extinct. And so this sounds like a long period of time, but geologically speaking, it's an incredibly short period of time to see such devastating losses among species. What's particularly concerning for people now is looking at this pattern, looking back and seeing, okay, these previous mass extinctions were precipitated by habitat changes and climate changes, and then also looking at the records that we have now of the numbers of species that are going extinct, and we can see a pattern emerging that looks a lot like these previous patterns of mass extinction.
You've each talked about essentially the glaciation, the 3rd that was also a global warming one, and then the one by the asteroid which killed off the dinosaurs. What about the 2nd and 4th? Do we need to know about those as well, Elizabeth Colbert?
The causes are very much debated. It's only about 20 years, maybe 25 years now that there's been sort of a general consensus, and even that I would have to say is not a total consensus about what caused the most recent of these extinctions at the end of the Cretaceous period. And when people just confirmed, guess that that was an asteroid impact, they found a crater buried beneath a lot of other newer sediment in the Gulf of Mexico. They went back to these other moments and thought, well, it would be very elegant if each one of these had been caused by an asteroid impact, and went to look for signs of that and just didn't find them. So there's still a lot of debate swirling around. As I say, you're looking at events that occurred a very, very long time ago.
It was very interesting reading through how these scientists were essentially coming to their realizations of what had happened through your book, The Sixth Extinction. Almost like a cross between a mystery story and a history book.
Sort of CSI, but the corpse has been dead for many, many millions of years.
We're dealing with essentially climate and habitat. One of the great extinctions was also climate. Are there things we can learn specifically from that, with the global warming that brought that on, and how we're dealing with the global warming of today? Annalee Newitz.
One thing that we can learn that's really obvious is that climate changes tend to precipitate these incredibly catastrophic events. Some of the other mass extinctions, for example, the ones that you mentioned, the sort of mysterious ones, both also involved, to varying degrees, invasive species. And that's another key link with what we're seeing today, where a lot of habitat changes on the planet aren't just being caused by climate change, but also by invasive species and how that's transformed different habitats for animals. The most obvious lesson that we can learn is that if we want to continue living on a planet that is comfortable for us and for our ecosystems, which of course we depend on our ecosystems to live, we need to be working very hard to remediate the effects of the climate changes that we're seeing. And the thing that's interesting about that is that, in a sense, that's a very unnatural thing to do, because if there's one thing you learn from looking at the history of mass extinction, it's that the planet is constantly undergoing these climate changes. And so for humans to, you know, come along and change the climate, whether to make it less comfortable for us as we are now or make it more comfortable for us, we are intervening in a natural process. But the fact is that right now we're in danger. And so our first task has to be looking at the ways that we can prevent further climate changes from happening.
Elizabeth Colbert, would you agree?
Absolutely. Many, many scientists are looking at this precisely because of some pretty sobering parallels that people see between what's happening now and what happened in the past. And I think one of the lessons people have extracted from the record, I mean, the very definition, as Annalee said, of a mass extinction is an event that takes place in geologically a very short amount of time. And some of these extinctions probably happened pretty quickly, certainly on geological terms. Is that when the world changes very fast, and, you know, it sort of intuitively makes sense, for whatever reason, you know, evolutionary processes, their pace doesn't change fast enough, and a lot of creatures get left behind. That seems to be sort of the bottom line inference that you can draw from these events. You know, the rate at which we are changing the atmosphere and therefore the climate, and also I should point out the chemistry of the oceans, which is implicated in several of these events of the past, is perhaps unprecedented since the end Permian extinction, which, as I mentioned, is sort of the worst extinction of the last half billion years. So that's a very sobering precedent, let's put it that way.
Well, Elizabeth Colbert, let's talk about some of the changes that we are observing that you documented in the book, and then let's talk a little bit more, Annalee Newitz, about some of the ways in which it could be possible to address these. You had chapters about some amphibians. You had a chapter on penguins. You talked about coral reefs, bats, sharks, something like 25% of mammals heading for extinction. It's pretty dire. Let's start with the penguins. What happened?
I should point out they were called penguins, but that was a complete misunderstanding. They're actually very, very distantly related to penguins. That was a great auk, I think, that you're referring
right,
to.
Right, that was the great auk.
That's a flightless bird that lived in the northern hemisphere. And then when people saw sort of somewhat similar, though they really don't look that much alike, birds in the southern hemisphere, they also called them penguins. But the great auk was sort of the original penguin. It was called a penguin before Europeans had encountered actual penguins. And those were flightless birds. Flightless birds, as we know, are very vulnerable to human predation. They are a very, very generally threatened group of animals right now, and many of them are gone, the dodo being, you know, perhaps the most famous. And the great auk was dodo-like, a big bird, waddled around, good eating, good, was used for just in a variety of ways, was just slaughtered, had these nesting colonies of, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of birds and made very easy picking. So one of the stories that I tell in the book is about this island that is in Newfoundland off the coast, and when European sailors found their way to the great cod fishery off of Canada in the 1500s already, they realized that this island in the summer was covered with these birds, and that they made extremely easy pickings and good eating, you know, at a time when you had just completed a pretty grueling transatlantic journey. And they just absolutely, you know, mowed them down, in that case, for food. Then they decided, oh, they were going to be good for feathers, too. Then they were killed for feathers. The birds themselves were lit on fire. They're very fatty. They were used basically to make fires. So it's really a pretty gruesome tale of slaughter, and eventually they were slaughtered down to nothing.
And is this a common story? Some of the others, the bats, for example, is not from humans eating bats. It's from some kinds of diseases that is a result of perhaps globalization. What are the other extinctions related to?
There are all sorts of mechanisms right now that are driving extinction, unfortunately, you know, sort of all at the same time. I mean, climate change is probably going to become a major driver of extinctions for fairly obvious reasons. You know, creatures are adapted to certain conditions, and we're changing them very rapidly. Ocean acidification, which is sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, that is also almost certainly a very significant driver of extinctions. Moving species around the world, the bats in the northeastern U.S. are dying from a fungus that was brought almost certainly from Europe. We've traced that back genetically. It was probably brought over, you know, completely inadvertently. Turned out to be very fatal for American bats. You know, obviously, habitat destruction, mowing down the rainforest, that's a big one, a bad one. Habitat fragmentation. So there's a pretty big list of them here. I guess I've named most of the big ones.
You mentioned the ocean acidification twice. We've talked about this on this program quite a bit. What's happening that's causing this, and what is the result?
Well, ocean acidification is really happening because when we pour carbon dioxide into the air, as we are by, you know, burning gasoline and burning oil and burning coal, a lot of it ends up in the water. It just gets absorbed by the surface waters of the ocean, which cover, you know, a lot of the planet, about 70% of the planet surface area. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it has an interesting property, which is that it forms an acid, carbonic acid. So it's a pretty relatively simple chemical process that's going on. We're dissolving CO2 in the water, and we are acidifying the oceans. The oceans should be pretty basic for those who remember their high school chemistry, with a pH of around 8.2, and that is dropping once again at a rate which people have tried to compare over vast stretches of geological time. And there have been several papers that have come out that have concluded that the rate at which we're acidifying the oceans is quite possibly, you know, unprecedented in hundreds of millions of years.
And so is this also connected to the coral reef die-off?
Yes, absolutely. There are a lot of things we're doing that corals don't like. They don't like it when the water heats up a lot. They don't like it when the water gets cloudy. They don't like it when there's a lot of agricultural runoff. They certainly don't like it when there's overfishing. But they also really don't like it when the chemistry of the water changes. And very many, you know, hundreds of experiments have now been run that demonstrate that. And so, for example, on the Great Barrier Reef, all of these factors are operative really on most of the major reefs right now. Studies suggest that the Great Barrier Reef, which is the biggest reef in the world, has lost 50% of its coral cover just in the last three decades.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking about the sixth mass extinction on Earth. Annalee Newitz, let's bring you back in here. You've been arguing that, yes, while humanity is causing all kinds of problems with the mass extinction, that it also might be able to solve these problems. Let's talk about some of those potential solutions.
Sure. First of all, I think the thing to keep in mind is that it's very likely that humans will survive a mass extinction. If you look back at previous mass extinctions, at the kinds of animals that tend to survive, they share a lot of characteristics with humans, namely that they can live in a lot of different environments the way we can, and they're very adaptable, and also they can generally eat a lot of different things. And as you may have noticed, humans are pretty good at eating almost anything, including garbage. So the question is really not whether we will survive, but how we will survive. And so what I urge people to think about in my book is, you know, how we can act now to prevent the future of our survival from being horrible. Because what it means to live through a mass extinction is not something that is exciting, as you might guess from a Hollywood film where you see lots of explosions. Basically, living through a mass extinction means starving and getting diseases. some of the things that Elizabeth talked about so amazingly in her book, where she talks about animals that are suffering from diseases that are caused by habitat changes that are a part of mass extinction patterns. So how do we survive? I mean, first of all, we have to think about the places where humans live. What are the places where we live, and how can we improve them so that we're living in the environment in a way that's not destroying it and not undermining animals' abilities to survive as well, animals other than humans? I talk a lot about how we can change city life, because cities are the place where most humans live now. The majority of humans live in cities. And that's only going to grow. The UN is projecting that by the end of this century, we're going to see as much as 75% of the human population living in cities. And cities are good in some ways environmentally, in the sense that you can scale needs for energy and needs for food better if you have people more densely packed. The other thing that's good about cities, ultimately, if we can make them sustainable and carbon neutral, is that it's a way of keeping people out of habitats that really should belong to other species. And one of the things that's really important as we think about the future and as we think about making a better future is reserving habitats for other creatures other than ourselves, habitats like the ocean, habitats like savannas, where animals need lots of space and they need migratory space. And it's a very difficult balancing act, because how do you create spaces for humans to grow our food and our energy, as well as spaces for animals? And so that's going to be a huge question, I think, over the next century, how we do that.
And with the UN projecting that we're going to have more than 9 billion people by 2050, how realistic is this?
Like I said, I think that's why cities become such an important issue, both environmentally and politically, because if we can take that population and keep people in cities, and I don't mean keep them in there, like imprison them, but I mean if people are living in cities, that actually gives us an excellent opportunity to think about how we start reserving these areas that people are leaving, these rural areas, and start reserving them for wildlife and for natural habitats, either by remediating habitats that are no longer comfortable for animals and making them comfortable again, or by just maintaining habitats that haven't been developed yet. So the thing that's, like I said, great about cities is that it's a way of scaling resources in a really good way, because people are densely packed, but it's also a way of keeping people localized in their own habitat. And as we look toward the future, one of the things that's very encouraging, at least in the United States, is that we're seeing a lot of investment in alternative energies and in fuels that will be carbon neutral or even carbon negative. And I think that, as Jane Jacobs argues in her work on cities, it's really important that as cities evolve, they start producing as well as consuming products. And one of those products, I think, is going to be energy. Whether that's biofuels that are grown in basically urban farms which ring cities, whether those are, you know, cyanobacteria producing energy that we bubble up in vats in our kitchens. I think that having locally produced energy that is efficient and carbon neutral is going to be a huge part of making cities more livable and sustainable. And ultimately, in the long term, what we really want are cities that function as part of their environments, that cities that function as metabolisms. How we do that is partly by incorporating living structures into our cities. And there are actually synthetic biologists who are thinking about this question. How do you build with living materials? How do you use things like algae to become lighting, for example? How do you modify algae to do things like water purification? I talked to one synthetic biology designer in my book who said that she feels like in the future, instead of killing mold in our houses, we'll be cultivating mold, because we'll be using it to do a lot of things that now we use incredibly wasteful industrial products for that pollute the environment. So I think that our cities might end up feeling a lot dirtier than they do now. They might look a little bit like ruins, but they'll be much more congenial in their environments. And that's our best hope, is that we can start really building with nature in mind and building as part of nature And I think that there's a lot of hopeful work being done right now in that area.
Elizabeth Colbert, do you share this hope with this vision that Anna Lee has put forward?
I certainly hope that these things, you know, come to pass. In my book, I really don't prescribe a future. I think that there are so many issues that we're confronting if we want to change the trend lines that we're on right now. All of the trend lines, all the ones that we talked about, all the big drivers, you know, of extinction. Unfortunately, the trend line is towards more and more impact as opposed to less and less impact. And to turn all those trend lines around, which we really, you know, do need to do if we're going to make a significant difference here in the trajectory that we're on, is a really massive global effort that's going to require, I think, you know, lots and lots of innovations and living very, very differently. As Annalee says, I don't know, you know, what the future is going to look like. I guess one of the interesting things has just been a lot of talk because it's the 50th anniversary of this 1964 World's Fair, which I actually attended as a very small child. I remember the It's a Small World ride, which I really, really loved. And, you know, to what extent those visions of the future came true or not. What did the future look like? The future, the technological future, is very, very difficult to predict.
There's a couple of other things, Anna Lee, in your book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, that I just wanted you to address. One had to do with the vertical farming, where farms were inside these skyscrapers. Every floor was solar powered with a greenhouse. How real is this?
It hasn't been tried on any kind of massive scale, and there have been a lot of questions and skepticism about whether it would really work and whether it would be energy efficient. The technology of the vertical farm is the idea that you would build a skyscraper that would be just pure greenhouse, basically. It would be letting in light, it would be using all recycled water and all carbon neutral energy to light the plants that weren't getting direct sunlight. And it's a beautiful idea, and I think something like it will have to exist in order for cities to feed themselves in the future. Whether it will be giant glass skyscrapers full of farms, or whether it will be farms growing on the outside of buildings, or whether you'll have something more like urban farming, which is basically just local farming, you know, farms that are right next to your city so that you aren't, you know, wasting energy driving fruit and vegetables all over the place. It's unclear how that's going to work, but I think the vertical farm is a fantastic thought experiment because it gets people thinking about how do you start manufacturing food in cities. And not to be too science fictional here, but one of the other things that people are thinking about also is stuff like synthetic meat. How do you start doing tissue engineering on a massive scale so that you don't have to be slaughtering animals and raising animals in terrible conditions in order to get meat protein to people who want to buy it, especially in America. In fact, across the Americas, people love meat, but of course, farms where people are growing meat are terrible for the environment, and a lot of the nutrient runoff is causing that ocean acidification that we were talking about earlier. So that's another futuristic goal along with the vertical farm that I think, you know, people really are going to be exploring quite seriously.
Let's end with Elizabeth Colbert. You've said that if we don't act, this sixth extinction will impact the future of the Earth for all time.
I should say all extinctions have impacted, you know, the future of Earth for all time because you close off certain evolutionary pathways, and those are gone forever. And so, for example, I quote a British paleontologist in the book talking about if the first of these extinctions, of, you know, 440 million years ago, if the survivors had been one jot different, so would the world today. It's only the survivors that give rise to new species, and these other pathways just end in dead ends. So we are, one of the points I stress in the book is without at all intending to, that's what we're doing. We're closing off certain evolutionary pathways, and you know, that's a pretty significant thing to be doing without even being conscious of it.
Well, let me thank both of you. Elizabeth Colbert's new book is called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Anna Lee Newitz's book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.